นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิSo the next chapter in this collection, third volume of Lumpur Samato's collected teachings, the anthology, chapter 25 is called Dependent Origination, number 4, Feeling, Conditions, Desire. So there's a series of five talks all on Dependent Origination. But before I start this one, I thought I would just follow up on a reference I made a few days ago, which is about the conventions of language, about how the Buddha speaks of using various terms in, say, different circumstances, or that, you know, language and concepts can only be relatively applicable. So I mentioned that, I thought it was from the Potapada Sutta, the passage about the different kind of a bowl, a cup, and a dish, and so on, that was remembered incorrectly. So in the Potapada Sutta, the Buddha does talk about the conventions of language and how things are figures of speech are used in kind of common communications, and they're not taken as absolute realities. So that's in the Digha Nikaya, the Potapada Sutta. The sutra I was thinking of is actually Sutta 139 from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is actually a book called The Broken Gong, which was edited by Ajahn Sajito, written by his former university lecturer, Harold Beaver. So Harold left his manuscript to Ajahn Sajito in his will, and when he died, and Ajahn Sajito put it all together and published it as this book. So it's helpfully included as a quotation here. So this is Majjhima 139, the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition on non-conflict. Don't cling to vernacular usage or override convention. And how does one cling to vernacular usage and override convention? By dogmatically maintaining, for example, that a certain object is called a dish, pati, in one part of the country, or a bowl, pata, in another, or vessel, vita, in another, or again a saucer, sirava, or a pan, dharupa, or a pot, purna, or a cup, hana, or a basin, pisila, in yet another, must invariably be called either a dish or a bowl or a vessel or a saucer or a pan or a pot or a cup or a basin in each and every locality, insisting, this alone is the proper usage and all the rest are mistaken. That would be an extreme case of local prejudice. So, as it says, if one varies the terminology as one travels through different regions, continually bearing in mind how these terms are variously applied to the same household object, then all partisan bias would be avoided. So that's and it also it's in a Dhamma talk about non-conflict. It's really very, very useful, very, very skillful, because oftentimes we conflict with each other, or we find that we have different opinions just because we're talking about the same thing but using different words, different ways of expression. And so that the Buddha is saying, you know, if you insist that only one term can be used, there's, you know, this alone is the proper usage, it's only a bowl, it's not anything else, you can't say cup or saucer or dish and so on, then that's exactly how we cling to opinions and find ourselves in conflict with each other. So that's a good sutta to get to know, Majjhima 139, the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. So I just thought I'd share that with everyone as a useful resource today. Any questions on that before we begin? Okay, so let's go to chapter 25, here we are, Dependent Origination, number 4. Feeling, Conditions, Desire. At the beginning of the practice, Paticca Samuppada is avicca paccaya sankhara. Ignorance conditions the karmic formations. Avijja is the ignorance of not knowing the Four Noble Truths. There is ignorance in any being who does not understand that there is suffering, the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to its cessation. Conversely, the word for knowledge in this sense is vijja. Vijja is the knowing of the Four Noble Truths, insight into suffering, its origin, cessation, and the path. And as I was saying the other day, this isn't just having the words down, dukkha, samudaya, nirodha, magga, or suffering, origin, cessation, path. But when it talks about ignorance is not knowing the Four Noble Truths, it's not seeing things in that framework, not seeing things in that kind of a format. And that right view is similarly taken as being seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So it's the kind of thing that we hear over and over and over again. But it's I think it's really helpful to take that to heart, that this is the lens with which we lenses of our glasses, the lens that we can look at the field of our experience, and rather than I like or I don't like, or this is a sound or a thought, or this is an emotion, this is a memory, this is an idea, rather, is there dukkha? If there's dukkha, what's caused it? If it's got a cause, then it can end. Yeah. And how can that end be brought about? So that it's just changing the way that the whole experiential field is held and is processed. That's what we mean by understanding or knowing the Four Noble Truths. It's really using that format for processing the field of our experience and perceptions. When we haven't had insight into truth, avijja, not knowing, conditions the sankhara. We create an I am. The sankhara, I am, is created and conditioned from that avijja. Notice that the First Noble Truth doesn't say, I suffer. It says, there is suffering, idang dukkang. There is dukkha. It's not saying that anybody suffers. However, we think we suffer. We think, I suffer a lot in this life. He's a real sufferer. She suffers all the time. I've suffered a lot in my life. I wasn't born with the best karmic formations available on this planet. And I've really had to suffer. Poor me. But the suffering is what we create out of ignorance. The important point the Buddha made was that we should live in accordance with knowledge rather than ignorance. This Buddhist practice is a way of knowledge, of knowing. It's all about knowing the truth. That's why I don't particularly feel sorry for anybody when they think they suffer a lot. I could say, poor thing, I really feel sorry for you that you've had to suffer. But thinking that one is suffering is not the position of knowing. Things have happened in the past, perhaps unfortunate occurrences, and then we think and indulge, which carries them on into the present with all kinds of additional suffering. But when there's knowledge, insight, vijja, we realize there's nobody to suffer. We see things as they are. Every human being has the ability to see the way things are clearly and not create suffering about it. Admittedly, we've all experienced unfortunate things, or done foolish things. This is just ordinary human experience. Once we're born, anything can happen to us. The whole range of life's experiences is possible for us, from the most fortunate to the most unfortunate ones. That's the result of birth. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the way it is. Birth in the human realm is risky. We can't be sure what we're getting into. It could be a real mess, or it could be a delight. Or it could be sometimes messy and sometimes delightful, or one quarter messy, three quarters mediocre, and no delightful things at all. So, Lumpo occasionally gets on these sort of imaginative riffs. So, one quarter messy, three quarters mediocre, and no delightful things at all. Being born in this human world into sensory consciousness is like this. It's unstable, uncertain, it changes, and we cannot find any security within it. This is what we all have in common. From the most fortunate to the least fortunate human beings, we're all vulnerable, being in a shape and form that can be damaged, hurt, and diseased. When we look at this, this side of our human existence, we don't feel prejudices and strong views concerning race, class, sex, nationality, and so forth. We're all brothers and sisters in old age, sickness, and death. So this Lumpur begins this with saying, and we, when there's avijja and not seeing clearly, we create an I am. So that's the there's these two Pali words that are used quite regularly in the teachings. Ahankara, ahang means I am. Kara is made or to make. So ahankara, made of I am. So the feeling of I am-ness. And then mamankara. Mama is the word for mine. It's the way of expressing owning and something belonging to us. So mamankara is mine-ness, also translated as I-making and mine-making. And I think Ajahn Tiridhammo has just been writing a book all about eye-making, soon to be published. So there's a lot to say about this, but this is the basic habit of the eye-making, mind-making. It's that in itself is a mental formation and not an absolute reality. So part of the development of vipassana meditation is recognizing that the I am feeling is just a feeling. It is just a perception. It's a useful mental formation, just like our hand or our ear or our eye or our tongue, our teeth and so on. They are formations in nature that have a particular purpose. So the I am feeling, or the mindness feeling, they're not just an accident or random. They have their form and their shape for particular reasons. They have they're structured for a particular purpose. And so it's just like our hand has a shape, or our eyes, or our tongue, or our ears have particular shapes and particular means of operating. So that the I am and the ahankara, mamankara, the I am feeling, the mine, the owning feeling, they have a particular place in us for human conditioning, our living as part of a group, functioning as an entity within a group of other entities, and operating as part of a living system, then it has a purpose. The problems come where that I am is taken as something that's absolute or permanent or a quality that has a substantial reality. And so that's where the dukkha arises from it, is that I am is not recognized as just simply a mental structure, a mental formation, but it's taken as an absolute reality. You know, I am, this is mine, I own this, this belongs to me, I have this, this is what I am. And that there's an absoluteness there which is deceptive, it's not true, it's not real. And that's where the dukkha, the dislocation, the disconnection in the heart arises. And so that's where the dukkha is caused. If that I am, or and the I-ness and mine-ness, the I-making and mind-making are recognized as what they are, seen in their true light, then there's no problem. Like I was quoting the Buddha from the Potapada Sutta. You use those conventions. I am, he is, she is, we are, you are, they are. We can use those personal pronouns and those forms of expression quite comfortably, quite realistically, but they're used without delusion. They're not taken as absolute, separate, independent entities. Rather, they're like a convenient figures of speech, as the Buddha puts it. So then in this, as Lumpur is expounding here, that you know, having been born with you have a mind, a body, a sensory system, then he says, every human being has the ability to see the way things are clearly and not create suffering around it. The Buddha recognized that some beings are more capable or more likely to see things clearly than others, that there are those with a little dust in their eyes, and there's those with lots of dust in their eyes, and there's a natural distribution within the field of living beings, so that that's say, I think, good to appreciate. But also having been born, as he says, being born into this human world, into sensory consciousness, it's like this. It's unstable, uncertain, it changes. We cannot find any security within it. So again, one of the causes of dukkha is trying to find predictability and certainty in that which is intrinsically uncertain. You're trying to find sureness in that which is not sure. And so that the kind of reflections that the Buddha encourages is to turn the attention around, and rather than follow that impulse to try and make everything predictable or hope that things are predictable and certain and can't be damaged or hurt or diseased, to instead turn right towards that and say, I'm of the nature to age, I'm of the nature to sicken, I'm of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So there's five subjects for frequent recollection, and the last one being, I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, and so on. So that goes against our sort of ego-centered conditioning and the kind of self-protective impulse that says, don't say that, or like, no, I want to arrange things so I'm never going to get hurt, I'm never going to get ill, I'm never going to experience any kind of loss. And even though that's natural enough, and we can work quite hard to look after our health and the health and well-being of those around us, it's a fundamental realism that the Buddha is encouraging, and that and saying, yes, well, we do the best we can, but it is an unstable situation. It is uncertain. You know, there isn't any security here. And so that you know, if you're looking for security in that which is insecure, you have to be disappointed. There's no other way around that. So that turning, that's a 180-degree turn to face and to meet that change, that instability, it's going against the instincts and habits of the ego, of self-view. But then the result of that is a great relief. It's a sense of spaciousness and ease in the heart. There's something that say, lets go of that self-centered thinking and recognizes, well, of course. Yeah, of course it's this way. And that you stop sort of hoping or for that which can't be satisfied, you know, that you're never going to get hurt or experience loss or difficulty or pain. That realism is intrinsically liberating, and rather than trying to pretend that we're never going to get old or never lose anything or that we're always going to have the things that we like around us, then it's a kind of wound to the ego, to self-view, but it's a big relief to the heart. And so that change, to turning towards the quality of change and uncertainty, to really accept it, open the heart to that, that's in a mysterious way, that's the gateway to freedom, that you're no longer looking for security in that which is insecure. You're not looking for completion in that which can't be completed. And so that you are bringing the heart in tune with the reality of nature. And then with that, as Lumpur ends this particular piece of the talk with saying that there's a powerful unifying quality that comes with that. As he says, when we look at this side of our human existence, we don't feel prejudices and strong views concerning race, class, sex, nationality, and so forth. We're all brothers and sisters in old age, sickness, and death. So that, again, can sound a bit depressing or off-putting, but I don't know about other Buddhist countries, but in Thailand, sometimes when somebody's giving a Dhamma talk, that's the way they'll sort of open the talk, will be to say, welcome to everyone, to all brothers and sisters in aging, sickness, and death, as a sort of, hello, here we are. This is a kind of bonding. Whether we are old or young, tall or short, female or male, or whatever our nationality or our social status is, whether you happen to be a queen or a king, or you happen to be a subsistence farmer or whatever place you are in the social scale, or how what age you might be, then we're all in this together. We're all sisters and brothers in aging, sickness, and death. And that's what, in a way, the Buddha points to as our fundamental relatedness. We're all part of this natural order, and that we don't have to focus on who's rich, who's poor, who's tall, who's short, who's healthy, who's unhealthy, the many and various ways that we kind of divide each other, our nationality class and race and so forth, that all falls into a secondary place, that whether you're the Queen of England or whether you're a newborn baby in a maternity ward, you're still subject to sickness and death. You know, that your status and wealth and so forth have no power to protect. We're all part of the same natural order. We all breathe the same oxygen. We feel the same force of gravity. We all need to eat. We are all impacted by the world through the sensory field, so that we share this. So there's a tremendous commonality, and that brings forth the qualities of kindness and compassion in relationship to each other as well. So any thoughts, questions, reflections? Yes.
Yes, Ajahn. I had a question about ahankara, working with ahankara, the activity of ahankara, especially in relation to, I find that when that arises, that formation of ahankara, it usually comes not only by itself, I am, or making the I, but usually becoming something very particular, like I am, you know, a clever person, or I'm someone who knows a lot, or I'm maybe clumsy, or, you know, like becoming a particular kind of identity. Mm-hmm. And I find it very interesting how, like, almost always when there's some sort of, when there's suffering, there's some kind of identity that comes with it, like praise and blame, for example. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm, you know, whatever, something negative, or I'm great, bringing happiness and pain. Would you say the most skillful way of working with it is to observe it and just investigate it, or how would you recommend working with this particular activity of eye making, in terms of making particular identities that come with suffering or happiness practically?
Rather like Lumpur was mentioning in his Dhamma talk yesterday, I think, about using conscious thinking and bringing words to mind and looking at the spaces between words and such like. And I've mentioned that in recent readings as well. So to deliberately explore that I am feeling, then either just on its own or loaded with emotionally or charged comments or personal comments, so that you bring the mind to as quiet and focused a state as possible, then deliberately bring in. Just you can do it in various ways, and it's good to experiment. But just to bring in the word I, just to notice what that feels like as a kind of like a mental event. I, not even I am, just I. And to notice the kind of tone or texture, the psychological feeling around that. And then I am, you can use that form, you know, I am, not I am anything, but just I am, or me. Me, this is me, or mine, this is mine. Just taking the simple and sort of undecorated qualities of I and me and mine, and feeling what the tone of that is, and how there can be a spacious, quiet openness, and just then thinking the word me, suddenly there's this kind of tensing in the heart, or a contraction, and or a heaviness. I mean, it's going to be different for different minds, but. Then those can be very revealing. then also particular judgments, like I am a smart person, or I'm a really conceited person. You know, I am conceited, or I am clever, or I am clumsy. And again, just without a big commentary, just taking a statement like that, and then noticing what arises around that. And with as little commentary as possible. So you just take a word like, a phrase like, I am clumsy, or I am clever, and just see what goes along with that. And often it's a sense of, at least when I've used this, the kind of a practice, almost always there's some sense of, this is absurd. It's kind of like, that there's something, the intuitive wisdom, the sort of satipanya faculty recognizes, well, that's not the whole story, or that's a bit ridiculous, or so what? it recognizes that it's only a partial way of describing things, and that the habitual usage of, you know, I am, as a kind of absolute judgment, that just has no strength to it, no real life to it. So that feeling of absurdity, like, oh, that's what a weird thing to think. Similarly, one of the interesting things, if you make it very simple and you just bring to mind the word I, or I am, then one of the things that can come with that is just a sense of weirdness. So, like, what's that about? When the word I is used, what's that referring to, really? Oh, and it's a kind of, almost like a vertigo. You sort of, there's a sort of unsettled quality. At least that's how I've experienced it. Also very very useful, and similarly, is to just use your own name. And that can have an even more powerful impact, because we get used to the name that we carry, like our sort of Pali name, or our family name, given name. And so that it's a very everyday usage. It's kind of, it's who we are, that's our name. And there's a very strong conditioned identification with that. You know, it's our name. It's who I am. And so it's quite loaded in that way. And when you sort of clear the mental space and let the mind be as quiet and as focused as possible, and you just bring your name into that space, that again, that there can be a strong sense of weirdness, or like, what the heck is that? Because the everyday usage of it is so habitual, and so the attachment to it is quite strong. And then when you just let that really be known and seen, then it can reveal those habits of eye-making and mind-making very, very strongly. Like that, oh, that your own name can sound like the weirdest possible thought. And so it's a useful kind of disorienting or unsettling. And gives a perspective on that eye-making and mind-making quality. So it's in a way most helpful to investigate those feelings in that kind of a fashion, I found, rather than just sort of in the everyday flow of activity, because there's usually sort of a bit too much clutter and things that I'm doing, or I'm in the middle of a conversation, or it's sort of in the flow of other things, that the attention gets caught by all the other elements going on around it. But just sort of clearing the mental space as much as possible, and just dropping that in, the I am, or Niddaro, what's that? And it can be tempting to sort of jump in and have a whole sort of commentary about it, or start making ideas about it. But just to stay with that dislocated or unsettled feeling, that's in a way I find the most helpful thing, just to recognize, yeah, that there isn't really anything solid here. There's this quality of awareness, there's this center of experiencing, this place where experience happens, but you don't even have to think the words, this isn't really a person. It's like in that moment it's known that the habitual way that the mind creates a person just isn't really valid. It just doesn't, it doesn't hold together. And so that the partial truth of, you know, what the name is, or the I am a person, or I am clumsy, or I am smart, or whatever it might be, that it's directly known, or that can only be a partial truth or a convenient fiction or just a sort of a handy way to talk about things, but there's no way that that's anything that's absolutely valid. And that's like directly known. That isn't an idea. It's a kind of non-conceptual knowing. That makes sense. So, but different people operate in different ways. But sometimes the trying to get a clarity on that eye making and mind making in the midst of activity or conversations and such, like, it's such a sort of deeply rooted and subtle attachment that you need to sort of clear the space around it to get to know it directly. If it's in the midst of a lot of other things, at least I found it's harder to really know that and to get quite so much clarity around it. Okay, I'll continue. Having been born, there's vijnana, consciousness. There's body, nama rupa. There are the sense organs, salayatana, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. There is pasa, or contact, with the sense objects. And there's vedana, feeling. This vedana is the result of birth and consciousness, and in this sense is applied to sensory experience, to the attractive, neutral, and unattractive qualities. The experience of vedana through the eyes doesn't mean that your eyes ache or hurt. It means that when you see beautiful flowers as attractive, lovely green and white chrysanthemums and so on, when you see beautiful flowers as attractive, the vedana of attraction is pleasant. There's also unpleasant or neutral feeling. That whole process will then stimulate desire, grasping and becoming, tanha upadana bhava. We become what we desire. Now apply that to all the senses and their objects, to sound, smell, taste, touch and thought. Some of our thoughts are very pleasant. Some are neither pleasant nor unpleasant, and some are unpleasant. This is the sensitivity of these bodies. They are totally sensitive conditions. They're conscious and they feel. This is just the way it is. Some of you only want to be partially sensitive. You're frightened of being totally sensitive. You'd like to become sensitive only to nice things, and you'd like to pray to God and say, "Oh God, please give me everything nice, only pleasant feelings, and please make everything beautiful for me. And never let me suffer, and let me always have success and happiness and beautiful people around me until I die." That's the whinging human mind wanting only partial sensitivity. Vijja, or insight knowledge, is knowing the pleasant and neutral and unpleasant as they are. We're not asking for partial sensitivity anymore, or for the best of the sensory experiences, but opening towards total sensitivity, which includes all possibilities for pain, ugliness, unpleasantness. Avijja says, "I don't want to lose my looks. I don't want to have any unpleasant experiences. I want to be happy." That's avijja. Vijja says, "There is suffering, there is its origin and its cessation, and there's the way out of suffering." So this is a very common theme of Lumpur's teachings, particularly in that era and now. So talking about the living system as consciousness on the basis of consciousness and sensitivity, and that's the, if you like, the vipaka of birth. Having been born, having these lives, then there's consciousness and sensitivity. The living system is set up to feel. And so that that, in a way, in attuning this living system to Dhamma, to reality, then part of that attuning means an openness to the whole range of feelings or perceptions, so that they're not afraid to be sensitive. And what he's talking about here is that if we are wanting to be partially sensitive, like only having pleasant, comfortable, affirming experiences, so I only want springtime and summer, I never want autumn and winter, then it's, well, it's not going to work that way. I only want praise, gain, success, and approval and comfort. I never want criticism, discomfort, disapproval, and loss. Then you're asking for something that just can't exist in the universe. Even in the Buddhist cosmology, up in the Deva realms and the Brahma worlds, still that you can have eons of blissful experiences, but at the end of those periods, then things start to decay, and those feelings of loss and destruction, the kayavayang, the disintegration process is still there, and so that it can seem a bit weird to say I want to be totally sensitive and feel everything, but it's based upon that, say, attunement to reality, that a readiness to be open to whatever life offers. And again, it's kind of going back to the Buddha's encouragement of the five subjects for frequent recollection, that there's something in us that wants to push away aging and sickness and death, and kind of pretend that doesn't happen. Like I often point out, particularly speaking about death, then in the West, often we use phraseology like, if anything should ever happen to me. We don't say, when I die. Well, in Buddhist circles, sometimes we'll say, when I die. But for many people, they say, if something should ever happen to me. It's like, that's a lot of padding. There's a lot of protection there. If, rather than when, something, rather than dying, should, all these conditionals. It's like, no, this body's going to die one day. But we push that away. We create these layers of padding, of buffering, because we don't want that to be true. But the Buddha's encouragement is, say, you're being unkind to yourself to rely on all that buffering, that padding. And it's, in a way, a greater kindness to say, here it is. This body is aging. Yes, that face in the mirror has got more wrinkles than it had last year or last week. But nothing is going wrong. This is just how nature works. Don't look at this as something bad or wrong. And that, Lumpur is encouraging that sense of openness, of being accepting that quality of consciousness and sensitivity. And with that, when those impulses arise, like I don't want to get old, or I don't want to be sick, or, oh no, not that, but those waves of feeling and thought, those attitudes, they do arise. But if there's wisdom, then we recognize those quite quickly, that, oh, that's the, oh dear, not the right leg as well. Oh no, not that one. My left one was just recovering, now the right one's going. And that, say, that's a natural enough feeling, but we don't have to take refuge in it. We don't have to make a lot out of that. So that we can recognize those human and so natural reactions, but we don't have to feed them or to invest in those a lot. Okay, so to continue. So contemplate this I am, quote unquote, that cries and weeps and fears and desires. Why are we frightened? What are we frightened of and anxious about? It is the possibility of pain, isn't it? Of being physically harmed, diseased, or emotionally exploited, or hurt in some way. Of being rejected, unloved, looked down upon, getting cancer or Parkinson's disease. I don't want that. I want perfect health. I'm afraid I might have some terrible disease. What if I have one of those heart attacks where for the next 30 or 40 years I'm kind of a cabbage and the monks have to do everything, put me on the potty? I don't want that. I couldn't bear to be a nuisance or a burden to anyone. I don't want to be a burden is an English obsession. Dhampur is very accurate. He'd already lived in England long enough to know that's very much. I don't want to be a bother. Don't want to be a burden, and that's a terrible thing for a Brit to be feeling. So I am, quote unquote, is something to contemplate and observe because it's something that we're convinced is a reality. Because of ignorance, I am is truth for most human beings. And it's very natural to want happiness and to want to run away from pain. You see something beautiful, you grasp it, you want it. You see something ugly and you want to get rid of it. Those are the natural reactions on the sensory plane. If that's all there is to it, you just have to try to get all the best you can and run away from all the bad, and there's no way out. It's each one for themselves, survival. The clever and the strong survive, and the stupid and the weak will be at the bottom, in the pits. But the human being is equipped with a reflective mind. We can reflect and contemplate Vedana. We can observe and contemplate what attraction is and what beauty is. We're not just dumb animals. We can actually watch ourselves wanting to grab and possess the beautiful. We can observe and reflect on our aversion to anything ugly and unpleasant. And we can also contemplate what is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So in making that kind of comment, this is one of those comments that, particularly in Britain, if you talk about dumb animals, you can get a very strong reaction. And so I noticed for myself also, and Lumpur and other people giving Dhamma talks, when you talk about the animal realm being really unfortunate or one of the lower realms, or you make these kind of comments like, we're not just dumb animals, there can be a sort of a rising up amongst certain members of the group saying, you haven't met my cat, Ajahn. My cat is a very spiritual being. Or and for many people, I think particularly English people, their cats and their dogs are often the greatest spiritual influences in their lives. And I grew up in a family of dog lovers, and that's how my parents met. They were both dog breeders, so I'm very familiar with the dog-loving realm, and so that it can be the case that when you make comments like dumb animals, that people take great offense to that, and that they have a lot of emotional support from the animals that are around them, and as they see very profound spiritual qualities in the animals that they live with, horses and dogs and cats and so forth. But in terms of Buddhist psychology, Buddhist cosmology, it's understood. And also, if you look at the animal realm, particularly the animals that are not living with humans or haven't been humanized, that the animal realm is one that's based on instinct and reaction. So that it's a pretty painful, challenging, a fear-filled, pain-filled realm, the animal world, and so that it's a lot of competition and conflict is there, an instinctual reactivity, so that even though some people find a lot of spiritual support and spiritual qualities in the animals that they live with, if we look at the animal world around us, the birds and the squirrels and the worms and so forth, then we can see that the life of the animal realm is generally nasty, brutish, and short, as one philosopher put that kind of description of this realm. A mode of being that doesn't have a lot of capacity to reflect, so that most animals can't reflect on their aggression. This morning I was seeing a blackbird with a worm in its beak. So the blackbird doesn't have the capacity, I would suggest, doesn't have the capacity to have compassionate feelings for the worm. It's looking for breakfast. It's looking for, it wants to eat. And yeah, you know, and the worm similarly is not thinking, oh, well, the blackbird's got to eat. I suppose I'm happy just being chomped down upon. I'll live with this. That's a human projection onto the animal world. But that sense of being bound by our instincts of attraction, aversion, self-advantage, that's what we mean by the animal realm, as one of the six realms. That there's no perspective on aggression or on territory or on sexual desire or on, you know, competition for resources and so on and so forth. It's those impulses fill the whole being, and so the mind is compelled or is driven to follow that. Say, trying to protect yourself or aggressing against others or trying to mate with others or get food sources to survive, so that it's a reactive and non-reflective realm in that respect. But as Lumpo points out here, the human being is equipped with a reflective mind. As a human being, this is one of the great blessings of this realm, is that we can reflect on a feeling. You can have a feeling of dislike and discomfort, and you don't have to react to it. You can respond, oh, this is painful, but I don't have to just compulsively follow this. Or this is attractive, this is beautiful, I don't have to own this or keep this or hang on to it or make it mine. I can just experience this liking and this pleasantness, this beauty, without having to want it and keep it and own it. So this is one of the great blessings of the human world, and as is pointed out, it's why the Buddhas are always born the Buddhas are always reach full enlightenment in the human realm, because it's got the fairly equal mixture of the pleasant and the painful. That the Deva worlds, the realms of the Devas and the Brahma gods are so much pleasure that it's hard to get a sense for dukkha and dissatisfaction. And then the realms like the animal realm or the ghost realm or the hell realms, they're so painful that you can't get a perspective on those painful experiences, and they're things that fill the heart and are, say, feeding out of obsession very, very easily. But the human realm, you have, as Lumpo Sumedho would put it, you have the body of an animal but the mind of a god. And so they have this mixture of pleasure and pain of just the right amount, whereby you can't get lost in the pleasantness, but you've got enough of a capacity to, enough spaciousness and comfort, enough psychological space to be able to reflect upon feelings of like and dislike, comfort and discomfort, and so forth. So that this is a great advantage of the human realm. And they use this in Tibetan Buddhism. They use this phrase, blessed human rebirth, as a sort of very common expression. But this is the most fertile territory. This is like the warm tide pools between the sea and the shore. This is where the most fertile area for our spiritual development. And so even though there are many challenges of the living in the human realm, the kind of blessing that we have, this mixture of qualities of the pleasant and the painful, the instinctual and the reflective, this is a kind of wonderful mixture that enables us to be able to fully know pleasure and pain and to be able to reflect upon it as well. So we can reflect and contemplate Vedana, and we can, whether it's painful or pleasant or neutral, that we have that capacity. And so that's, even though you might feel resentful of the challenges of the human world and living with other people, I think it was Jean-Paul Sartre said, hell is other people. Is that right? Yeah. Other people is hell, l'enfer. Les autres, c'est l'enfer. L'enfer, c'est les autres. Hell is other people. So I realize that the human realm is indeed challenging, but those challenges are also the opportunities that we have to really liberate the heart, and that and as for myself and other people, sometimes it'd be so much simpler just to be an animal, just to be a dog or a cat or a horse or a squirrel. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? And so frequently I've encouraged people, don't think that. it might look from the outside so idealized point of view, but it's not wise to be relishing or to be admiring that kind of dependence or dwelling in that instinctual reactive realm, that even though there's challenges to the human condition, that this has got the most powerful opportunities for development of wisdom and liberation. So this is why Buddhas are always enlightened in the human realm. It's not when they're born as devas or as animals that the samasambodhi always comes in the human realm. So I think it's worthy of consideration. Any questions, thoughts? Please, if you could use the microphone.
Ajahn, if the physical body and the jitta is like in a separate thing, so do you believe in the way of like, if the jitta is some of the people, that a jitta is, you're born in the human realm, you have a human body, but a jitta is like you do a lot of bad things.
Is what?
A lot of bad things. The bad.
Not bad.
No, unwholesome. Yeah. Unwholesome thing. And then the jitta is like, go to the animal realm. Even the jitta is like animal realm, but in the human body. So you have that, why some human have like some behavior like aggressive or eating like an animal or something like that. Do you believe that kind of thing? So.
I think that's one of the main aspects of the teaching on the six realms. It's not just speaking about cosmology and sort of between one life and another, but it's talking about mind states, how we get born into different modes of being. And so that I don't think it's a matter of belief. I can see that happening in my own life and in the world around me. So that the six realms are, in that image you have of the bhavachaka, the wheel of becoming, the image of that is actually that it's a mirror, that it's that circular disc that's being held up, and so that it's not just it's a circular shape divided into five or six sections with a different realms, but it's a mirror being held up by Mahakala, which means the great time, Mahakala. So that you're looking at yourself in that mirror, and so that then the different mind states that we can be in. So when the mind is full of say very wholesome pleasure. Wholesome qualities and say bright mind states, then it's like being in the deva realm. If the mind is caught up in sort of aggressive animal tendencies, and like you're kind of arguing with Sister Jayavira, and you want to have revenge on her because she's done something awful, so you want to destroy her. Then it's like the mind is caught in the animal realm or the hell realm, and so that it's not just between physical lifetimes, but it's the mind states that we experience moment by moment, day by day, and then the six realms are a way of naming the different moods and also seeing the effects of being caught in those particular moods, and that And also part of the imagery that you have in that, of the Bhavachaka, the wheel of birth and death, is that in each of the realms you have a Buddha. So in the Deva realm, the Buddha's got a veena, like a musical instrument. In the human realm, the Buddha is a bhikkhu. He's got the alms bowl. In the animal realm, he's got a book, like a palm leaf manuscript of teachings. In the hell realm, he's got a fire. He's got a torch, a blazing torch. In the I think in the asura realm, he's got a sword. And then in the the hungry ghost realm, he's got a bottle of nectar, kind of sweet nectar to feed the hungry ghosts. So that there's a Buddha in every realm, which means even if you've got an angry impulse and you want to blow Sister Jayavira up, that you can the image of the Buddha being in that realm is, this is a feeling of I want to blow Sister Jayavira up because she's really annoying, and that's what that is. It's just this feeling of destructiveness. And then, so the imagery of having a Buddha in that realm, Buddha with a blazing torch, is that there is the capacity to know that state. So that it's not like a picture of the Buddha visiting the hell realms or visiting the animal realms. It's a psychological map. So that there can be a kind of an animal feeling of greed for food and or sort of competing getting upset with somebody coming into your territory. That's my cushion. Don't move my cushion. That kind of recognition that this is getting upset that someone's entered my territory. That's an animal instinct, and so that mapping of our different psychological states is very, very helpful. And so that then, the other day I was mentioning how the manusa loka, the human realm, is defined by living by the precepts. And so that's what makes a manusa. So the if you're living by at least by the five precepts, then that means that you're sort of inhabiting the manusa loka. And there's a recognition of the quality of goodness, the beauty of virtue and goodness, and so that's something that's naturally attractive and beautiful in the human. If the mind is abiding in the manusa loka, if there's a human body, but the mind is locked into animal instincts, you want to go to boxing matches, or that you're just obsessed with food and how you can get the most sort of delicious food, the biggest quantity that you can get away with eating, there's a human body, but the mind is really in the animal realm, and so on. That I feel it's helpful to understand that it's not just speaking about rebirth in terms of bodies, but it's most helpful as a psychological map, and that there's a Buddha in every realm. In that imagery, and so that even if you have animal instincts or you're lost in a sort of deva realm, you're kind of having really blissful meditation, everything's really great and this is so beautiful and pure, that there's a Buddha in that realm as well, that's saying this is the experience of beauty and purity that's like this, and that then is pointing the way for that understanding to be a real source of liberation, and that it's a way to free the heart from being locked into that wheel and just sort of going from one realm to another to another to another, but being able to let go, to transcend the wheel altogether. Does that make sense? So maybe that's... Any other questions, thoughts, reflections? So I think it's 7 o'clock just about, so let's call it to a close there today.